Tell the people what you're here for.
Bring everything out closer to the people.
Uh-uh, we got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Am I on?
The first person will fight.
True for faith.
Radio Basics.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
What's going on? This is Justin here with my homie David Chin. David Chin, what's going on, man? It must be good old Monday. We are back in the studio with another show.
I do not have a case of the Mondays.
No, I never do when I'm doing the radio show, man. Only when someone else is doing it. And not me.
Yeah, damn right.
Yeah,
pissing me off.
All you other hosts. All right. Well, we got another great show. Because I said so.
I'm still not convinced. Yeah. We'll see.
we'll check in with you at the very end then, Dave. We got some news, obviously. We've also got...
We got news.
We're going to talk about the Tamils.
Okay.
That event that went down right in the middle of the Gardner Expressway.
Let's call it an event.
Six hours. We're going to talk to Professor Mark Harold, whose research on Afghanistan, I think, is unparalleled out there. And he's going to come on the show, and he's going to talk to us a bit about what's going on. So, Dave, you got your report ready? Or should we jump to international first?
I say we jump to a song first.
Yeah?
Start it off with a nice groove.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm going to do something short then. And it's a good one. Let me just check the track number. Number 9. Okay, CHRY, Radio Basics, 105.5. Check it out.
Have a seat.
Chains holding me. I wish I could say everything I had to say. Say it loud, say it clear for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Everyone
CHRY 105.5 Radio Basic. We are back. That's a dope song. I wish I knew Nina Simone.
Yeah,
Nina Simone cover. So
Dave, I love her.
Hit us with some headlines, Dave.
Headlines. I'll give you one headline.
Okay.
If that's okay.
Yeah.
Just one though.
Okay.
You're not deserving of more than one. Okay. And it's kind of serious, so I'll stop the joking. You want to turn off the music stuff?
Okay.
Cool. So, as some of us know, there have been over 6,000 deaths of Tamil peoples by the Sri Lankan state over the last week. This is an insane amount of people who have lost their lives.
Truly.
By a Sri Lankan state that is acting in a genocidal fashion.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely morbid.
Yep.
And there has been a lot of protesting over the last 2 weeks, a lot of which has been getting some mainstream coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's irritating on many levels. One, here at Radio Basics, we definitely support the national liberation struggle of a people like the Tamils.
Yeah, we've done a few shows on it, I think.
We have, and we definitely support it.
Mm-hmm.
What's really irritating for me is seeing and hearing on mainstream radio channels people coming on the air and saying, oh, we disagree because, oh, I know, I was trying to go visit my mom on Mother's Day, and they inconvenienced me because I couldn't get through the route and this, that, and the third. Okay, it's an inconvenience.
Yeah.
Understood. But the problem is not that you're being inconvenienced, but that there are thousands of people en masse being slaughtered by the day.
Yeah, where's the bigger injustice, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think we all need to support, and if you can, you need to go out there. The next protest is at Yonge and St. Clair, and I would advise that everyone who supports peoples who are fighting for national liberation to go out, show your support, bring your family, your friends, coworkers, and all, and show your face, show support, because it's incredible. Like, people dying on that level hasn't happened in a while. The last thing I can remember is Gaza, the attacks on Palestine.
Yeah, it's just something en masse like that. Like, even in the early days of the Afghan war, it was something to the order of 3,500, 3,600, like, I mean, 6,500 in 2 days, it's like almost unfathomable, really. But, just to pick up on your point about the mainstream press and their coverage, just coming home from work today, hearing, like, talk radio, like, just people calling in, and even the radio hosts, like, I mean, AM 640 and News Talk 1010, like, both you guys are dirtbags. Like, whoever was hosting in the afternoon, I don't even know their names, but they, like, one reporter was saying that the police should have stepped in and beat them all. Like, it's just like, well, it's really the police's fault for not clubbing them in the head when they started going on the Gardener.
That's disgusting.
Yeah, it's really sad. I mean,
the majority of the protesters are women and children.
Youth, women
who probably work 12 hours a day and are coming at night and whenever they can because their people back at home are being slaughtered. And it's not some arbitrary protest. You see, Canada has been supporting the Sri Lankan government.
Yeah.
And so is America. So it's not like it's a protest that has nothing to do with what it is that we're doing here. And it seems like just because we interrupt the smooth operation of your day-to-day mundane lives, that's enough for you to be, oh, well, they should be clubbing them.
Yeah.
Like, you're advocating brutality on people, mostly women, because you can't get to work on time.
Yeah, and even they chose a Sunday night, like, obviously, because they didn't want to, like, cause a mass disruption of, say, Monday morning or Tuesday morning. Mm-hmm. Like, they need to make a point. They have nothing to do. Think if you were in that situation and, you know, your family was being attacked
hypothetically, you went away to Greenland on vacation. You and a bunch of your family.
Yeah.
And out of the blue, Obama says, you know what? Hey, Canada, I don't like you no more.
Yeah.
And they start bombing and killing Canadians on thousands, and you protest in Greenland. Mm-hmm. Are you going to be too happy when Greenland's like, well, stop a bit. We're trying to go to the park, and your little protest is pissing us off.
I know. Oh, man. I don't even know what to say.
Just think about it.
Yeah, and don't listen to 640 or News Talk 1010.
Ever.
They're the worst. So, okay, we're going to do commercials, and we're going to come back with Professor Mark Harold, and
Yep.
Talking about some Afghanistan.
Yeah. CHRY 105.5.
CHRY 105.5 FM. Broadcasting at 158 watts at 105.5 FM. On the World Wide Web at CHRY.FM. And on the Rogers Digital Network, channel 945.
Funky, funky, get out. Trying to survive, trying to stay alive.
The ghetto, the ghetto.
Talking about the ghetto.
The ghetto, the ghetto.
Funky, funky, ghetto.
CHRY 105.5. We are back. Radio Basics. Thanks for tuning in. Right now, we're going to go international. So as the U.S., Canadian, and NATO forces approach their seventh year occupying Afghanistan, it seems like the violence projected onto the civilian population is increasing day by day. Dozens of civilians were killed Tuesday, May 5th, in a U.S. bombing in an Afghan village, Bala Baluk, in what may be one of the highest civilian death tolls of the war. Witnesses say U.S. warplanes bombed scores of houses during clashes with Taliban fighters in the western Afghan province of Farah. The Pentagon says it's investigating. Joining us now is Professor Mark Harold, an economics and women's study professor at the University of New Hampshire. Professor Harold has methodically followed the invasion since its beginnings in October 2001. He has constructed the Afghan Victims Memorial Project, which, as much as possible, has listed the names of those that have perished at the hands of Western imperialism. Along with the list is a dossier outlining the daily contours of the occupation and assault with what might be the most rigorously documented research database on the war. He joins us now. Welcome to Radio Basics, Professor.
Good evening. Glad to be here.
So before we get to your two most recently published manuscripts, I want to go back in time and just have you explain why you undertook such a project and why you didn't leave the reporting up to the mainstream press.
Well, a number of things played in here. It wasn't just one thing. The most immediate reason was a request to contribute a chapter, a request I received at the end of October 2001 to contribute a chapter to a book which was being written about America's Afghan War. I mean, already back then it was billed as such, and of course it continues to be exactly that. So that was the most immediate reason, and I was asked because I have a fair amount of experience constructing large databases, empirical databases from all kinds of different sources. I was a bit reluctant to get into this. It seemed like a really big project. But the editors of this book convinced me that I was the person to do it, and so I decided to do it. Your second question, which is, of course, a very good one, is, why didn't I just let the Western and particularly American media do it? Well, the answer is very simple, is that I think the American media has been absent without leave, to put it mildly, in most parts of the world over the last maybe two decades or so. There are all kinds of reasons for that. So it was clear that the American media generally, the mainstream media, was not going to do the work, and somebody else had to do it, so I decided that I was the person to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of your articles was entitled, "The AP Speaks Newspeak." Can you just elaborate on that?
Well, I think the AP in particular is guilty of misrepresenting what in fact is going on in Afghanistan, but in other parts of the world too. For example, in the Middle East, it's fairly well documented that the AP has consistently had a pro-Israel basis in its reporting on that conflict. And generally, I think going back to all the way back to February of 2002, the AP was beginning to finally take notice of what was going on in Afghanistan, and they came up with the most absolutely preposterous figures as to what in fact the numbers were with regards to innocent Afghans who had been killed. So since then, it had consistently been that way. In fact, there's kind of a rule of thumb, and that's that the AP typically gets about one-third to one-half the accurate numbers in terms of civilian casualties. On the other hand, when the bad guys, quote-unquote, attack a convoy or a improvised explosive device goes up, the AP quickly rushes to the scene and reports in gory detail, including photos of the people who were killed. So there's a clear bias. I mean, in effect there, and I have written extensively about that, there are quote-unquote good bodies and there are bad bodies. The bad bodies are the bodies which result from our doing. We, the United States, NATO, Canada, and so on, we don't want to talk about those. And the good bodies, which are the bodies killed by our perceived enemies.
Mm-hmm. In Canada, we have a soldier death toll of about 100,
right.
which is usually reiterated when another soldier dies.
Of course.
But most recently in Balabalak, that number was surpassed.
Yes. In a matter of 1 to 2 hours on the evening of May 5th, you had a terrible bomb. It was a combined ground and aerial attack, but most of the people died as a result of the aerial attack. And there is a list of names, which was individual names. I mean, listing name and age and, so on, of 147 people, which is available. I don't have it yet, but I will have it shortly. This is not fairy tales. This is pretty about as accurate as you can get. I basically have a rule of thumb in the work I do, and the rule of thumb is, look, I'm only going to count and put into my, Afghan body count, names of or individuals when I have a fair amount of detail. So the more detail, the better. The more, as far as I'm concerned, the more detail, the more credible. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I've helped form the Iraq Body Count Organization, which has done the same kind of thing with regards to Iraq. We have a very similar kind of methodology. It's not entirely the same, but it's fairly comparable. And in March 2003, January, February 2003, I helped form that organization. So, there's a lot of experience here in terms of this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. So before we get into your most recent article on Obama, can we just go back to October 2001 and just discuss those initial events in Afghanistan, the bombings, and what you documented from that?
Well, that was really quite different from what been going on in the last few years, because in beginning on October 7th, the United States launched its bombing attack, and basically had a ground war going on too. It was a limited ground war. You only had 400 to 500 CIA operatives and U.S. special forces on the ground, but they were there primarily to do two things. One is to provide guidance to some thousands of Northern Alliance soldiers who basically had been bribed. I mean, the leadership of the Northern Alliance was basically bribed with, and this is open information, with hundreds of millions of dollars to do the fighting on the ground. The small group of 400 to 500 Special Forces CIA people were really doing the coordinating. That was the first task. And the second task, maybe an even more important one, was really a fairly high-tech one, and that was to coordinate the bombing with some, fairly advanced equipment in terms of laser pointers and GPS systems and so on and so forth. This was a ground war. I mean, this was a full-fledged war. Between, on the one hand, you had the Taliban and their, a small number, it really was a fairly small number of Al-Qaeda and a somewhat larger number of Pakistani volunteers. And, on the other side, you had the U.S. Special Forces CIA teams and a couple of Ranger, later on Ranger battalions, and a large number of Northern Alliance troops. It was a ground war. And the Taliban and their associates, and I know this for a fact, had discussed internally, what are we going to do? How are we going to fight this? And, one faction said, we can beat the Americans like we beat the Soviets. We can do it, so we'll take them on. And the other side said, No. You know, things have changed dramatically. This is 20 years afterwards. The United States has absolutely unsurpassable air power and information gathering technology and so on. We don't stand a chance. We can't fight a ground war. If we do, we're going to get destroyed. Well, that latter faction won the internal debate, and you know, for about a month and a half, 2 months, the Taliban and associates, as I like to call them, tried to fight a ground war, and of course they lost, and they probably experienced somewhere between 8,000 and 10,000 casualties. It was hopeless, and you know, finally in December, I mean, they decided to disband, which was of course the right thing to do from their perspective. Now, when you had this kind of a war taking place, where you have very, very heavy bombing, I mean, we're talking about 14,000 tons of bombs dropping within, two, 3 months, you're going to have a lot of civilians who die. And so, you know, that was my job in those first 3 months, was to try as accurately as possible to get some sort of number on, you know, what was the human cost on the Afghan side to this war. And I came up with an initial number of 3,500, which was later revised downward to about 2,900.
Mm-hmm. Right, so moving forward to your newer article entitled Obama's First 100 Days, The Afghan War is Becoming America's War, which was published on Global Research.
And elsewhere,
yes. On your own website, of course. And
it was also translated into Spanish. It's been translated into German and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, that's a whole other story.
Mm-hmm. This document goes over sort of the overall character of the U.S. occupation under Obama. Can you just give sort of a general rundown of that overall characteristic?
Yeah, there are different facets to it. The most important thing to say here, that this is really a continuation of the Bush program with a little tweaking. There's a little tweaking, but in essence, and certainly as far as Afghan civilians who are not involved, it makes absolutely no difference. And in fact, I would argue it's actually worse, the level of lethality is becoming higher than it was even under Bush. It's not surprising that, you know, last weekend we had thousands of people demonstrating across Afghanistan against, the occupation forces and calling for the immediate withdrawal of NATO, the United States, and so on and so forth. It didn't get much reporting in the United States. It did get some reporting in Europe, which is, you know, kind of interesting. Anyhow, so let me, your question. First of all, more troops. I mean, clearly. Obama promised the American electorate he was going to withdraw troops from Iraq. He did that, but he just moved them to Afghanistan. What are Americans saying to that? Nothing. That seems to be okay. Secondly, more training for the Afghan army and police. Well, we know that. I mean, that's been tried under Bush. And the Afghan police is basically ineffective. It's dysfunctional. It doesn't work. The Afghan army, there are a few battalions which seem to be able to fight reasonably well, but it's a relatively small number. So we know where that leads. I mean, the Bush administration has been trying to train the Afghan army and police for 5 years, and, you know, not very much has happened. And it's not only, you know, the Bush, the American soldiers doing this. I mean, the Germans have been involved, the French have been involved, and so on. Okay, and the third component is more reconstruction aid. Well, It's easy to do more than Bush did, what is the more? I mean, if you're doubling from a very small number, that really is meaningless. That's exactly what happened. Obama is doubling from an incredibly small number, details of which are in the article. You mentioned Obama's first 100 days. You can get the numbers there, but it's a very, very, very small number. And this really isn't going to make any difference, all the more so because, you know, somewhere between the Taliban have a permanent presence in somewhere between 50% and 75% of Afghanistan. And these areas, most of those areas are simply off limits with regards to NGOs and the rest who engage in, so-called reconstruction and humanitarian aid. It's simply too dangerous. And you know, this has been, and you know, maybe for your listeners, I mean, some of them are wondering, well, you know, how could, you know, how can the resistance target, you know, humanitarian efforts? Well, the reason that that's, you know, in there, talking from the resistance's point of view, fair play, is because what the United States has done since 2004, they've set up these PRTs, or Provisional Reconstruction Teams, which is really the Vietnam model. And that is, you have military operatives, you know, soldiers who engage in fighting and killing, but you also have, you know, so-called public affairs, troops there, anthropologists, and so on and so forth, who do the quote-unquote humanitarian. And, you know, the humanitarian organizations are up in arms about this blending, this mixing of, on the one hand, military and humanitarian. And this has sent out an absolutely terrible message to the people in Afghanistan, Afghans, that, you know, they're the same. And so, you know, it's not surprising that humanitarian folks get targeted. And so it's really become very, very dangerous, even including for, you know, people working for the United Nations, Oxfam, other kinds of organizations. So the reconstruction is, you know, that's not really going to work. And the last one is, you know, focusing upon Pakistan. Obama's actions in the last, you know, 2 months have contributed to the complete destabilization of Pakistan. It was bad enough under Bush. Now we have a nation teetering on the verge of collapse. And the reason is very simple. Obama has brought the war to the Pakistan border areas, and in so doing has created tremendous instability in Pakistan. And Pakistan's, the Pakistan government is incredibly weak, and has been for the last, you know, 2 or 3 years, even under Musharraf. So I don't know if this answers. The last thing I maybe say is that, you know, under Obama, democracy building and all that kind of stuff's out the window. We don't talk about that anymore. We don't talk about women's rights. We don't talk about democracy building and all that stuff, which is, you know, the darling of the liberals, the liberal interventionists, or what I like to call the humanitarian imperialists. You know, there's none of that anymore. There's no facade anymore. We don't talk about that. So, you know, that's the program. And, you know, as far as concerned, you know, with regards to, you know, the average Afghans, I think it's a pretty bad program.
Definitely. And I think so, too, has Harper. And the Canadian government followed suit a little bit. I mean, most recently you have Harper, Prime Minister, going to the in a parliamentary debate and also reiterating his points while actually in Afghanistan, saying, and quote, we have 35 countries working within the government of Afghan, rebuilding their country. We are providing knowledge, financial assistance, and security. Security that allows the Afghan people to build a system of justice, develop and grow their economy, construct schools, hospitals, and irrigation systems. And it seems, though, behind the sort of speech facades and the seemingly innocuous language of democracy and Obama's new Afghan strategy, military upsurges seem to be what is behind the door.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mentioned earlier, and this is important, a tweak. And the tweak is that although, you know, the May 5th incident, which you referred to earlier, where somewhere between 127 and 147 people died, civilians died, the tweak is to allegedly, I mean, what the military, the Pentagon, and so on is saying in this country, we're going to rely much less on airstrikes. And, you know, to some extent, up until that, you know, event last May 5th, that was true. And so what we get is we get many, many more ground operations. These ground operations don't kill 100. They don't kill 30. They don't kill 70. But they kill 3, 4, 5, 7 people. And if you have many, many more of those, you're up to 140 very quickly. And, you know, this is the kind of thing which I document, meticulously documented. And, you know, I check, double check, and so on and so forth in terms of, you know, the figures which I report, and I have people in Afghanistan who help me on this on the ground. So I'm really confident with the data. So, you know, it's tweaked, but it's really public relations stuff because the Air Force bombing has gotten such a terrible, terrible, press. that I think the Pentagon, the U.S. military, had to do something. And so what we get is we get, you know, many more ground operations and, you know, midnight attacks or late night attacks and so on and so forth, which kill, you know, 2, 3, 5, 10, and so on. You can, you know, you can see the gory details of all of that in the database which you referred to earlier, and that's the, you know, Afghan Victim Memorial Project. And, you know, just for your listeners, you might be interested in this, up through yesterday, May 10th, under Obama, this is just the Obama period of time, there are 332 to 372 innocent Afghans who've died. Every single one of those is chronicled in my database.
Mm-hmm. And just to add to that, it seems you had a quote from Hillary Clinton who says that she offers her deep regrets, right?
Right, right. Well, I mean, that's part of the thing. I mean, that comes from the Afghan ambassador to the United States, who about 2 weeks before Hillary said that, wrote an article where I think he got very red in the face afterwards, but anyhow, he did write it, and he said that, oh, you know, all the Afghans really want is, you know, that the Americans come and apologize.
That's it. Problem solved.
I mean, really, I mean, this is what Saeed Jawad, who's the U.S. Afghan ambassador in Washington, you know, said, and I guess that sort of rubbed off on Hillary Clinton, but it certainly didn't fly well in Afghanistan, I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't think it would. Now, you mentioned in your article that you have disaggregate data. What demographic is dying and from what? Yeah. Can you elaborate on that and speak about what you term the democratization of death?
Well, okay, two questions. You know, what I've done in order to, you know, be credible, but also, you know, to open myself up to challenge is, you know, unlike the United Nations and Human Rights Watch and the Associated Press and all sorts of other organizations, I present disaggregate data. That means case by case, every single incident, exactly like Iraq body count. That is the same methodology with Iraq body count. We're the only ones who do this. All the others come up with these aggregate numbers, and you kind of wonder, well, you know, where do these things come from? I want to see the raw data. You know, social science research, I mean, I'm an economist at the university, and, you know, one of the basic rules in social science research is that you have to be able to reproduce the results. A skeptic should be able to go and look at the data and reproduce the results. We can't do that with all these other so-called counts. Mm-hmm. Why should I believe the United Nations when they tell me, you know, 2,000 people died in 2008? I want to see the raw numbers. I want to see every single day. You know, compiled. I do that. Iraq body count does that. So that, you know, that's the difference here, I think, between Iraq body count myself and these other so-called counts. The second question, the democratization of death. Well, I mean, that really goes to, you know, who is being killed. And, you know, I have a chart in that article, which, you know, gives people a sense of, you know, how dangerous this American war is. You know, I'll just give you a few examples. You know, January 24th, a grandparent is killed in U.S. close air support. February 16th, a number of nomads are killed. A cook is killed by U.S. special forces. A mother, a father, mm-hmm. an unborn fetus.
Oh, wow.
At 30 a.m. on April 9th, et cetera, et cetera. Two farmers, a little girl, a tribal elder, a middle school principal, a male motorcycle, shopkeepers, four sons, and so on it goes. I mean, there's no end. A government employee, a driver. That's what I mean by the democracy of death. Kind of like during the Great Depression in the United States, as I like to, you know, say, the Great Depression in the United States was pretty democratic. It hit everybody. Yeah. And, you know, that's what is happening in Afghanistan. The American war in Afghanistan is hitting everybody, is killing everybody. It doesn't matter who you are.
Mm-hmm. Or like the sort of the bailouts in America, yeah. they socialize the losses, but you know, keep the benefits to themselves.
Absolutely.
So, have you received a lot of criticisms from your work? I looked at one reporter from the Weekly Standard.
Oh yeah, he's a famous one. Yeah. I know that one.
what has been the sort of criticisms of your work, and what are your thoughts on it?
Well, you know, I would say in the last 3 or 4 years, there really hasn't been much criticism. I think the big problem in this country, and it really is a big problem, is that my work is largely ignored. And so, you know, you have people relying upon the United States, Nations data and so on and so forth. My work is not ignored in Asia. It's not ignored in Europe. In fact, it's regularly translated. It's widely cited. And I think that there are different reasons why this is the case. And, you know, the case is that I'm very, very harsh about on the issue of, you know, humanitarian imperialism, that I really do believe that, you know, this is something which happens. You know, you have these people who such as Samantha Power and Christopher Hitchens and others who believe that, you know, the United States has the right and the duty to intervene around the world to restore some kind of system which is quote-unquote better. And I don't agree with that. And I've been very, very harsh on that. And I think that has, you know, it has created problems. You know, on the other hand, you know, if we go back to, you know, the early years when I was doing this, you know, 2001, 2002, even 2003, oh, yes, there was an enormous amount of criticism. And some of it was really kind of silly, and that's that, you know, I made one or two or three mistakes, and therefore, in terms of double counting, I've corrected those. As you know, I said earlier, I mean, initially I said 3,500 were killed in the first 3 months of the U.S. war, and I revised that downward to 2,900. I have no vested interest in having a higher or low number. My interest is having an accurate number. And that's why I published the disaggregated data, so that if anybody wants to challenge me, go ahead and challenge me. You know, on the other hand, I mean, I've received some incredible feedback, including from an officer in the United States Army who was in Afghanistan and wrote back to me after he had come back to the United States and wrote back and said, "Dear Mr. Harold, I'm absolutely astonished with the accuracy of your reporting, and I would really like to speak to you. I would like to tell you more about what happened that day. What you said was completely correct. You are the only person who correctly reported that." He subsequently sent me photos of the people who were slaughtered by F-15s in that particular incident, and I won't give any other details. But and I've received many other comments like that from people on aircraft carriers in the Indian Ocean and elsewhere. So, you know, overwhelmingly, the response, I think, has been favorable. On the other hand, I mean, there certainly are people like in the Weekly Standard and so on who basically nowadays have no credibility anymore, I think. You know, what they've been writing about Afghanistan, and, you know, they were the spear, the head organization of, you know, the U.S. new imperialism, that we should really become a new imperial power. And they were writing about this, you know, beginning back in 1997. I think they've had their day. Their day's over. And the specific criticisms which Jason Mravchik raised in that particular article, I think I've dealt with a long time ago. So I'm, you know.
Okay. I guess before we cut to commercial, we would ask one more question. Sure. That being, if we are then to cut through the sort of trope of imperialism through the language that they're using, whether they use this tweak or that tweak to sort of define what it is that they're actually doing, in your professional opinion, based on your research, where do you really see this going, this mission, as they call it, by numerous countries in Afghanistan?
Well, I think everybody agrees that it's basically a stalemate. Neither side is going to succeed militarily. I don't think that on the NATO, U.S. Kabul regime side that, there's going to be much change in terms of reconstruction. I think the actions of the United States first and, you know, subsequently the United States and NATO have transformed the conflict in Afghanistan from, it was really a conflict, I think, between the United States and on the other side, the Taliban. And now it's a much, much, much broader thing. It has now become basically a national liberation struggle in Afghanistan. And the emphasis in Afghanistan in many, many quarters is, you know, foreign forces have to get out. After that, we're going to start sorting out what we're going to do. And, you know, this is, of course, the Taliban's position, too. And ultimately, I think, you know, the NATO and the United States will withdraw because it's simply too costly. It's costly in terms of bodies. It's costly in terms of dollars. And, you know, whatever, German D-marks and, you know, Spanish euros and, you know, so on and so forth, German euros. You know, it won't work. And so I think what was going to happen is, was well captured by, in an interview which I love to cite, because I think it says so much. And this was an interview between a British journalist and a Taliban commander who we finally was able to meet up in the mountain area between Afghanistan and Pakistan of 2003. And they had their interview up there, and at the end of the interview, there was a pause, and, you know, the British reporter didn't really know what to do, and the Taliban commander was looking at the English gentleman's, the English journalist's very, very complex Rolex wristwatch. And he had his very, very fancy wristwatch, and, you know, it was this awkward pause of about 30 seconds. And I'm telling you, like the journalist said it. And, you know, the Taliban fellow looks up in his eyes and he says, "You have the technology, but time is on my side." and that, I think, is exactly, that's where it's at. And so I think there'll be fatigue. And we already see that in Europe. I mean, the Europeans are, look at what happened when Mr. Obama went to, you know, to Europe in April to try to get a lot more troops. He didn't get any, or he got very, very few. I mean, come on, if you get 200 troops from Poland, what difference that's going to make? you know, that's not what's going to do it. You know, if you want to, you know, occupy the place, you're going to need somewhere between 400 and 5,000 soldiers, and that's just not realistic. That's not going to happen. The Europeans are tired. They see nothing in it. Why are we doing this? And that's a damn good question. And, you know, so I think that NATO is ultimately going to, you know, shut down the operation, and the United States will be left holding the bag. And I hope for you folks up there in Canada, the Canadians get out, you know, before that happens. And the United States can't do it alone. So, you know, it's sad that, you know, we had a new administration coming in here. I think there was the possibility of some radical change, and we didn't get that. We just got a deepening of the Bush strategy.
Definitely.
Yeah, truly unfortunate.
Unfortunate, especially for those Afghans who
absolutely
are going to face the brunt of this for what seems to be years to come.
Yeah. Professor Harold, we thank you for
my pleasure.
For your work and for coming on the show. Can you just let the listeners know where they can access any more of your research?
Well, there are three different places. You can go to a website called cursor.org, cursor.org, and you go on there, and you scroll down the right-hand margin, you go to a file called Archivistan, just like an archive, Archivistan, and you'll see a lot of my essays collected there. And then the other thing, website, that's a little bit more complicated, but you can find it if you go to Google and type in my name, do a Google search for Mark W. Harold, H-A-R-O-L-D, and you'll get my university website, which will have all the databases. I mean, you'll have the initial database, a huge one covering 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004, then you'll have the Afghan Victim Memorial Project and many other kinds of things. So you know, you can certainly find me there. M-A-R-C, not a K, M-A-R-C. W, middle initial, H-A-R-O-L-D. You do a Google search in quotation marks and it should take you there.
And I truly urge all the listeners out there to look at it, because it humanizes what is dehumanized on a daily basis.
I think daily we see images of the soldiers.
Yeah.
They're glorified as heroes and fallen soldiers. Rarely do we get a chance to see the human side of those who are taking the full massacre that has been enveloping since 2001.
Okay, Professor.
Absolutely. If I could just say something on that. In fact, there's a whole separate section on my university website which has over 1,000 photos of the you know, the human dimension of this initial bombing attack and subsequently occupation. Over 1,000 photos culled from all kinds of different places. It's really quite amazing.
And unfortunately growing. So with that, thanks again, Professor, and hopefully follow up and have you on again.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Feel free to do so. It's my pleasure.
Awesome. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, that truly was informative. I mean, that guy's research is unparalleled. So with that, we're going to go to a track, and then we're going to come back. Radio Basics.
Yep. That was a premature yep.
Close your mind. Close your eyes. See with your heart. How do you forgive the murderer of your father? The ink of a scholar is worth a thousand times more than the blood of a martyr. We came through the storm. Nooses on our necks and a smallpox blanket to keep us warm on a 747 on the Pentagon lawn. Wake up, the alarm clock is connected to a bomb. Anthrax lab on a West Virginia farm. Shorty ain't learned to walk, already heavily armed. Civilians and little children is especially harmed. Camouflage Taurus, Bibles and glorious Qurans. The books that take you to heaven and let you meet the Lord there have become misinterpreted reasons for warfare. Reread them with blind eyes, I guarantee you there's more there. Rich must be blind, cause they ain't see the poor. Yeah, need to open up a park. Just close 10 schools, we don't need them. Can you please call the fire department? They down here marching for freedom. Burn down ATVs, turn ATVs on the teacher. Let me move. The more money that they make, the more money that they make, the better and better they live. Whatever they wanna take, whatever they wanna take, whatever, whatever it is. The more that you wanna learn, the more that you try to learn, the better and better it gets. America, yeah. Now the poor Ku Klux Man see that we all brothers, not cause things the same, because we lack the same color, and that's gray. Now that's May, can't burn this cross, cause he can't afford the gasoline. Now if a Muslim woman's trapped with a bomb on the bus, with the seconds running, give you the jitters. Just imagine an American-based Christian organization planning the poison water supplies to bring the second coming quicker. They ain't living properly. Break them off with no democracy. Turn their whole culture to a mockery. Give them Coca-Cola for their property. Give them gum, give them guns, get them young, give them fun. But if they ain't giving it up, then they ain't getting none. And don't give them all, no, man, just give them some. It's the paper, some of these cops must be Al-Qaeda. Get the more money that they make, the more money that they make, the better and better they live. Whatever they wanna take, whatever they wanna take, whatever, whatever it is. Give them pen, make them pull gold from river. Give black man crack, blocking things. Give red man craps, slot machines. Now bring it back, 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 bring it back. Don't give the black man food, give the red man liquor. Red man food, black man hemorrhoid. Again and tool, make them railroad villa. Also give them pen, make them pull gold from river. Give black man crack, blocks and ting. Give the red man craps, slot machines. Now bring it back, 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 bring it back.
Get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag.
When I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call goes back home.
Born to a throne, stronger than Rome, a violent prone, poor people's zone. But it's my home, all I have known, where I got grown, streets we would roam. Out of the darkness, I came the farthest, among the hardest survivors. Learn from these streets, it can be bleak, accept no defeat, surrender, retreat.
So we struggle in,
fighting to
HRY 105.5. We are back. We were going to have an eyewitness account of what went down at the Tamil protest, but unfortunately we've run out of time. I thought we had way more time. So yeah, unfortunately, sorry to our correspondent out there, but maybe next time. So yeah, I think that's it for Radio Basics. I mean, we had a couple callers there. Thanks for calling in. If you want to access Basics, you can do so by going to http basicsnewsletter.blogspot.com. We have our new issue out, issue 13, in celebration of May Day.
Read it.
Yeah, read it. Because it's great. And if you just want to look at the pictures, that's cool too, because we got a lot of them. And I mean, it was it's one of our most solid issues. We went big for the May Day celebration, and we got a lot of info in there on gentrification and on the Tamil protests and what's going in the developments in Sri Lanka, Afghanistan, and pretty much everything. And so actually, I think we're bringing our correspondent onto the radio at the moment. So. Let's see if he's there. Hello. Hello, Stephen.
Yes, Radio Basics, you found time for your long-lost Basics correspondence.
We did. I thought we didn't, but we did. So welcome to the radio waves, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you, sirs.
So, Steve, you were there last night on the Gardner, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Basics had a few correspondents there, mm-hmm. as the listeners of Radio Basics may have already seen from some of the accounts on the corporate media, or from our website, a demonstration down Spadina by a large group of Tamils and non-Tamil supporters stormed the Gardner Expressway, leading to what was probably one of the most effective direct action demonstrations by like a non-organized labor mm-hmm. Demonstration in, I don't know, in Toronto's recent history, for sure. You know, there was probably a good 5,000 people there. At one point, the whole on-ramp at Spadina, at the foot of Spadina, at the Gardner Expressway, was completely filled, as well as both lanes of the highway. A good 1,000 people deep on each side. So yeah, there was probably a good 5,000 people there. Riot cops all around. Serious police brutality. You know, with young, 100 to 120 pound women holding down the front lines in front of the riot cops.
Mm-hmm.
The police nonetheless felt the need to crack a couple skulls open, arrest some people. I believe at least two individuals have been charged, non-Tamils in particular, who really didn't do anything wrong. They've been charged with bogus charge of mischief. And I think all the Tamil protesters who were arrested were released. So what we're observing is a tactic of intimidating, in particular, non-Tamil protesters and allies in order to further isolate the Tamil community. And for those of you who have been watching the media, what we see is the media's spin on all this is to throw into question the whole legality of the takeover of the expressway, saying that Tamils have crossed the line, but yet nobody is questioning the legality of a genocide that's being carried out in Sri Lanka by the Sri Lankan army against Tamil civilians. Over the weekend, from the latest reports I've read, over 6,500 innocent civilians were killed in a matter of 48 hours. Probably one of the greatest genocidal crimes of the 21st century. An atrocious scale of horror in a period of 2 days. And what the media, the corporate media in Canada is doing, is asking whether it was legitimate to take over the highway, mm-hmm. when the Canadian government is supporting the Sri Lankan state, it's sending aid, so-called humanitarian aid or aid to the Sri Lankan government, and the international community, so-called at large, is also supporting the Sri Lankan government. Why is the legality of that not being put into question?
Mm-hmm. And it seems like they shifted the debate to sort of the narrative of the commuter right, last night, not say the Tamil voice and the Tamil story in all this.
I have you know, full confidence that those so-called commuters or general, you know, average Canadians, if they would be presented with the truth, the sheer scale of the horror of, you know, I met one gentleman yesterday at the demonstration who told me he lost every member of his family this weekend. Right?
Wow.
That's a bit of an inconvenience for that man.
I know.
I don't think that any commuter, no matter what kind of appointment, wherever they had to get to at 10 o'clock at night on Sunday, whatever inconvenience that was imparted upon them, I don't think that measures up to the inconvenience of the 300,000 plus Tamils in the GTA area who are losing their family members, their brothers and sisters, grandmothers, grandparents, and children at home in Sri Lanka right now. In Tamalilam, which is the nation that occupies the northern part of the island.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, you had Ignatieff too, who spoke out and said he was going to bring the issue to Parliament. And I mean, if, like, whatever that sort of means and whatever he can do, at least you now have sort of that reaching the upper echelon of the Canadian government.
And this is what the demonstration was trying to do, mm-hmm. to force Canadian politicians who are supposed to be our elected representatives who listen to the people, right? The Tamil demonstrations have been increasing and escalating for weeks now, right? And this is what this demonstration was meant to do. And I was there the moment when the call came in to some of those Tamils, some of those individuals, that the Liberal Party was going to raise the issue in Parliament. At that moment, a person came up, stepped up on the megaphone, asked the crowd of 5,000 people to quiet themselves. I don't know how many people have the control and self-restraint as a crowd of 5,000 people who can quiet themselves in an instant. And that woman said that we've gotten word that you know, there's going to be this motion, and the crowd left the Gardiner Expressway.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mind you, this also came at the same time that the police chief, Bill Blair, was saying that people had, 15 minutes to get off the Gardiner Expressway, they were going to forcefully remove them. Now, what Canadians should realize is that the Toronto Police did not have the power to do so. They had lines and lines and lines of riot cops, but there were 5,000 determined, you know, and extremely indignant protesters there who would not let their resolve break in the face of a couple batons when their family at home were having bombs dropped on them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think this is a really important lesson to draw for Canadians, especially workers right now, in hundreds of thousands who are losing their jobs,
mm-hmm.
that it's precisely actions like this and mobilizations like this that get the job done.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. I think that was eye-opening for a lot of people, but we got to close up. We're already over our time limit.
Yep.
But we have to support this. We have to.
Yeah. Every nation has the right to determine their destiny, to choose their political leaders, and to determine their economic system, and we have to support Tamalilam in that struggle.
Definitely.
Well put, Steve.
Radio Basics supports the Tamils.
Thanks, Steve.
All right.
Bye.
Good night.
See ya. And that is our show.
Mm-hmm.
Radio Basics.
Yeah, it was a good
Very good show.
Yeah.
I'm impressed with myself.
Thanks to our host who
David
follows
Chen.
Us, or thanks to you, but I was thanking the guy, after us. I'm sorry, I don't know his name. He plays the blues show after, if you're tuned in for
Vince,
that.
Vince, I think.
Vince, thank you for, letting us go over. So, Radio Basics out.
Later.
Bye.
David Chen.
We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Trouble. Trouble. 2, 4, 5, 3.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.